Today during Cap Radio special coverage, Getting Outdoors, what you need to know to navigate the world of recreation during the coronavirus pandemic. Also, many California outdoor spaces have names connected to controversial leaders of the past, how that's being addressed during a nationwide social shift. And we hear from a survivor of the Holocaust and how her family stayed together during Nazi occupation. I'm Randall White. Join us just after the news. This is Cap Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White. Today we're exploring the outdoors. Peak summer vacation season is here. And let's face it, some fresh air would be good for all of us right about now during the pandemic. But COVID-19 isn't the only major news story happening this year. There's also a social shift that's changing the conversation around race. Part of that has to do with the naming of landmarks and monuments. And when you head to California's outdoor spaces, you may find yourself visiting an area where this tension is on full display. This piqued the interest of Cap Radio's Scott Rodd, who knew there were landmarks in California with Confederate ties. He decided to look into it and see how many were still around and joins us now to talk about what he found. Scott, pleasure to chat with you this afternoon, as always.
Randall, great to be on.
Yeah, so what did you find when you started to look into it?
So as you said, there are a number of landmarks that are named after Confederate leaders and Confederate figures. And one that caught my attention was Jeff Davis Peak in Alpine County. And, you know, there's been some effort over the last couple of years to rename this peak, and it's, you know, stirred some controversy locally. Yeah. So I decided to go up and spend a few days up there, hike the peak and camp out and get a feel for the peak itself and then also the debate around it in the community.
And in some cases, it seemed like these changes can happen overnight. I mean, we saw the monument to Sutter in front of the hospital in Sacramento come down pretty quickly. This process in Alpine County has been going on for what, a couple of years now?
It started in 2017, and that was also something that piqued my interest about this. You know, monuments and statues, they can be taken down pretty quickly. Usually the conversation about taking them down takes a little time, but the actual decision can happen virtually overnight. But when it comes to renaming geographic landmarks, that process really takes a long time. And part of the reason is you can't just remove a geographic landmark. It's there to stay. And under federal law, I learned that you can't just remove a name. Once it has a name, it has to be replaced with something. And that requires sign off from a number of different agencies and different interested parties.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go with that. The even if locally the county wants to change it, as was the case with Jefferson Davis Peak or Jeff Davis Peak, and they had a replacement chosen by the Washoe tribe native to the area, these other hurdles are what has now stretched this out to a multi-year process.
Exactly. So even just getting local sign-off is only the first step in the process. It then has to go to the state to get approval and then to multiple federal agencies for them to sign off as well. And as you said, there were some hurdles along the way. When the name change went to a state committee, they looked at it and said, you know, the new name is hard to pronounce. The proposed name is Dayak Dalgoat Mountain, which stands for Saddle Between Two Peaks, and that's a Washoe tribe phrase. So they said it's a little hard to pronounce, and we're not sure if there's a local association. I spoke to Irvin Jim, who's a member of the Washoe tribe, and he had this to say about that.
Typical white society thing to say. They don't understand. They don't know. They, you know, and they don't take the time to try to understand it. This is our homeland, over 10,000 years of being here. And for us to have the ability to start putting names, Washoe names, the way they should be back into these places, it's really important.
That's really surprising to me that the state looked at it and said it might be too hard to pronounce.
And, you know, I should say that the state did go back to it and say, OK, we are going to approve it. They came up with a compromise that does stick with that name. So it is moving forward. But initially, yeah, they said a little hard to pronounce. And we're not sure what the local connection is, which may have rubbed some people the wrong way.
Right. And so on that note right there, what was the local connection to Jefferson Davis?
Well, I couldn't really find a direct connection to the man, Jefferson Davis. You know, in fact, he opposed the creation of California altogether because California was going to be a
free state.
A free state without slaves. So he was vehemently opposed to it. But historians say that the name came from a number of settlers in a mining village just outside of the peak. And they renamed it because they had immigrated from the U.S. South in the around the time of the U.S. Civil War.
So, Scott, you spent some time in the great outdoors for this story, of course, and you recently heard from some of our listeners about how they like to spend time outside during the pandemic. Can you tell us about Isolated Together, which is the series that you've had since the pandemic broke out, before we hear your latest episode?
So the series asks listeners to submit sound of what it sounds like for them to be isolating and keeping distance. And part of that came from a reporting challenge of just practically thinking about how can we as reporters get sound when we are in our homes and when many other people are in their homes. So this was an interesting episode because the state is starting to open up and we said, hey, we'd love to hear what it sounds like for you to be getting outside in safe and creative ways. So we gathered that sound and put together the story.
And here it is.
Just because we're spending more time at home doesn't mean we can't find new friends.
Oh, hi, my darlings. Are you ladies hungry?
Of course, those new friends may not have much to say in return. Alicia Piona lives on 5 acres in El Dorado County with her husband and 3-year-old daughter, and just a few animals.
We have a dog, a cat, and 14 chickens of varying breeds. We have 9 adult hens, a Polish rooster, and we recently added 4 baby chicks to the flock.
Piona is a nurse in Sacramento. When she gets off a long shift, she likes to decompress on the sprawling property. Even the chores around the farm, the feeding, the mowing, the weeding, have taken on new significance, giving her a sense of self-dependence. But if she ever needs help, her daughter Isla is usually willing to lend a hand.
Did you catch one of our chickens?
Uh-huh. I catch this one. You can hold her.
That's a good idea.
Piona says owning 5 acres helped get her family through the hardest parts of the stay-at-home order.
We are very fortunate to have a natural space to isolate in. Living in an apartment at this time may feel extremely confining. And my heart goes out to those who don't have access to nature.
Speaking from experience, staying in an apartment right now can get claustrophobic real quick. But what about spending the last few months on 4 wheels?
Life in a van right now, certainly a little bit unusual.
Ben Yu is a disciple of the van life trend. He was already on the road in mid-March, taking a break from his bartending job in Sacramento, when coronavirus fears gripped the nation.
So I decided to just continue on the road trip, just keep on going.
He spoke to me from behind the wheel, en route to Oregon. He's experienced some hostility from people who disapprove of his travels, but Yu says he's doing it safely, avoiding crowded settings and instead exploring solitary passions, like base jumping. The practice of leaping from cliffs and bridges with a parachute strapped to your back.
Base jumping for me has always been kind of a special thing, a great way to get that emotional release.
He recently found himself standing on a cliff in rural Idaho. Where most people would step back from the edge, you took a step forward.
3, 2, 1, see ya.
His parachute burst open, leaving him suspended in thin air. Not a bad way to stay socially distanced. For some, there's joy in simply being around nature. For others, it's about the challenge of trying to capture its beauty.
I'm Ann Ward. I'm an artist based in West LA. And during the pandemic, I've moved my practice outdoors to the yard to paint. Where I'm really fortunate to have a couple vegetable beds and some flowers.
A single painting can take Ward several hours or even days to finish. In a natural environment, a lot changes in that short period. The light dances differently as the sun arcs overhead. Buds blossom, petals wilt.
It's just such a joy to be able to slow down, and finding that process is so calming and restorative.
She says capturing this moving mosaic on a canvas is a cathartic exercise right now, a small act of imposing order on unpredictable surroundings. Scott Rodd, Cap Radio News.
And again, Scott joins us right now. And Scott, I got to say, each one of your isolated together pieces have been fantastic. I just, whenever I introduce them during All Things Considered, I find myself getting lost in the story and forgetting that I'm in the middle of anchoring a shift. You really play with the sound so well. I appreciate that. We're going to talk to Cap Radio's Ezra David Romero in just a second here. But before I let you go, we probably need to summarize what's happening with that Peak name change that we were talking about just before your piece there, Jeff Davis Peak in Alpine County. Will it change?
It looks like it's on its way to changing. So after 2.5 years of going through this name change process, the final hurdle is for the U.S. Board on Geographic Names to sign off on the name change. And so it looks like that may come as early as July. So that mountain may be getting a new name soon.
All right, Cap Radio's Scott Rodd, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Scott. And as we mentioned, this is the first week of summer. Cabin fever brought on by COVID-19 restrictions likely have you craving to get outdoors. I know it does me. But what is actually both possible and safe to do during these unusual times? Well, Cap Radio's environment reporter Ezra David Romero has some tips from the experts for us, and he joins us now. Hey, Ezra. I think Ezra needs his mic to turn on. It's on. Hey, Ezra, let's get right to the basics. What should we know?
Well, health experts across the board, whether they're in the outdoors or a health recreation expert, say wear your mask, don't hike with a lot of people, don't cross counties, and don't travel really far to get to places. I spoke with a woman named Miranda Worthen. She's an associate professor in the Department of Public Health and Recreation at San Jose State. She studies this nexus. She's basically saying that, you can go out and you need to toggle the idea of your mental health and your physical health. This is all super important because just yesterday, there were something 7,000 COVID cases in California in just one day. So it's a big deal. Going outside, we should do it, but you have to really think about who you're going to put at risk. Whether one of her big things was that you can go, but bring all your own food, bring everything you need in your own car. Make sure your gas tank is filled up, because the more exposure you have with people in different counties and different places, the greater the likelihood that they could catch COVID if you're a carrier or if you have it. And you may not know you do.
Yeah, it's that whole point that you made about not crossing counties that seems really hard to do. I mean, especially living in Sacramento, we're surrounded by such great outdoor beauty, but it's in a variety of counties.
Yeah, it's sort of all about evaluating risk, and so the guidelines are to go with people that are only in your immediate household. But when you do go with friends, you have to understand that you're only as safe as the most conservative person in that group, the person that's taking the least amount of risk. And if you're taking a lot more risk, you could mess up their life in that way. Here's some advice from her.
If you go to, a regional park or a state park and the parking lot's full, maybe take that as an indication to go a little bit further down the road to the next entrance to see if there's going to be fewer people there, because you still don't want to be in crowds. It's not a good idea to have a barbecue where there's going to be 30 people clustered around a grill.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Ezra.
So she has one of the main points that she talks about too is to not be extreme about what you're doing this year. This might be the year to take a step back. And if you're an extreme backpacker or a rock climber, or you like to go travel really far on these road trips, this is the time of year to explore the area around your home and the foothills around where you live, and go do all the routes, go do all the trails in that area. Yeah. For your own safety and for others.
And you've been doing that, Ezra, in about, 10 seconds, literally 10 seconds. How have you done that safely?
By all the things she's talked about. We went camping this weekend and we brought all the stuff we needed. We didn't talk to anyone else, really. We just were on our own. And
All right. Cap Radio's Ezra David Romero. You can find his stuff online at capradio.org. And we are back in just a moment. This is Cap Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White. Even in the most inhumane and turbulent conditions, the heart can find and keep hope. In her memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, Irene Butter shares her experiences as a child and a teen during the Holocaust. Her family, parents, brother, and Irene stayed together through their imprisonment in two Nazi concentration camps. Cap Radio's Donna Abedoni recently spoke with Irene for Cap Radio Reads, and here's an excerpt from that podcast.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience. You, as a small child, lived in Berlin with your family, with your parents and your brother. Had the Nazis already started to come into power?
Yes. The Nazis came into power when I was 3 years old. And of course, over time, everything happened gradually, but they became more and more visible. There was the Hitler Youth. They wore a certain uniform. And of course, there was the swastika, which became the symbol of Hitler's ideology. And it was all over the place. You couldn't help noticing it. Not that I grasped the meaning of it at that point, but it changed the country. It changed our lives. Not right away, but in a very deep way as time went on.
The first camp that you went to, is it Vesterbark? Is that how
yes.
It's pronounced? What kind of a camp was it at Vesterbark?
It was called a transient camp. Most people in Vesterbark were deported. Most people were not there very long. As happened to the Frank family, they were there very briefly. And were then deported to Auschwitz. But that was pretty close to the end of the deportation. Well, just sort of the quintessence of Vesterbork was the fact that every Saturday afternoon, a train pulled in. And it was a cattle car train coming back from Auschwitz after it had taken hundreds of people from Vesterbork to Auschwitz. Well, the camp was divided by a railway track. So you couldn't go anywhere in the camp without crossing the track. And when that train pulled in, this ominous train, and of course we knew where it came from, it stood there all day Sunday, all day Monday. You couldn't help seeing it. At the same time, knowing that at Tuesday morning, the barrack leaders would turn on the lights and read off the names of the people to be deported, mostly to Auschwitz, early in the morning. You got up, you listened for your name. If your name wasn't on the list, there was always somebody in the camp, either a relative, a friend, a neighbor, who did have to leave. Then we spent the rest of the night together until they were to board the train, and knowing that most likely we would never see each other again.
You mentioned hunger, and I have been told that once a person has gone through a hungry time in life, that is never forgotten. Did you notice that? Do you feel that there was an effect of hunger after you were out of the camps?
Definitely. I think all my life I've been sort of have pathological attitudes towards food. I cannot waste food. And when my children were little, I would always eat the leftovers until we got a dog, partly for that reason. I've never been able to get beyond that. A feeling of insecurity, it never goes away, because hunger is an indescribable experience, I think. I do not have words to describe what it's like to be hungry, let's say months after months, day after day, you never satisfied, you never have enough. There's no way of dealing with it because it's perpetual.
Why did you wait so long to tell this story and write this book? Why did you decide in the mid-80s that it was time?
Well, there were a number of prompts, actually. One of them, my daughter, who was in middle school, took a course in public speaking. At the end of the course, she had to give a one-hour speech. And she came home and told me, the topic I chose is anti-Semitism, Hitler's conquest of Europe, and the concentration camps. And will you be my visual aid? She said. And I was flabbergasted. I had never talked public about it and hardly ever private. But how could I turn her down? This was my daughter. And then in the late 80s, I was invited to speak on a panel. It was the occasion of an Anne Frank exhibition that traveled. And as I was thinking about this panel, what would I say? It suddenly dawned on me, Anne Frank will never be able to tell her story other than the diary. And I'm alive. I was given that gift. So I need to tell the stories.
Saying your story, telling those words the first couple of times, was it moving for you? Did you find that freeing right off the bat, or did you find it difficult at first?
It was difficult at first. It created a lot of tension and anxiety, and it was kind of like opening the scars from way back, from long ago. But then I listened to Elie Wiesel. He was a survivor, and he was the spokesperson for both the victims and the survivors. And I heard him say, and it's a quote in my book, if you were in the camps, if you smelled the smells and heard the silence of the dead, it is your duty to be a witness, to provide testimony, and to keep telling your story. And that made a very deep impression on me. And as I went on, I felt more and more importance attached to the role of being a witness. Because if there are no witnesses, it helps, you know, the Holocaust deniers. Silence is really not fruitful in learning lessons or trying to change the world for the better.
Holocaust survivor Irene Butter discussing her memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, with Cap Radio's Donna Apodoni. Hear the entire conversation at capradio.org reads or wherever you get your podcasts. And this has been Cap Radio special coverage for this Wednesday. You know, we started bringing you these half-hour extended local news segments in early May, gave us a chance to break down important information regarding the pandemic. Then in late May, reaction to the killing of George Floyd and the social outcry that has really maintained since. Since then, we've gone back and forth covering these two ongoing stories. Starting tomorrow, this time slot returns to All Things Considered. I'll pop up on the other side of the clock as interim host of Insight starting in mid-July, Beth Ryak. Her last day on Insight is next week, so be sure to catch those shows as she retires as host. I look forward to meeting with you again as part of the Insight team. For now, stay well. I'm Randall White.